hearing.
Senate Human Services Committee, and we're going to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 443, and we will call the illustrious Bill Markham to the table first, and I want to welcome Bill to the Capitol. Yes, Barney, if you want to come up, and Ed, if you want to come up, but I just wanted to take a moment to acknowledge one of the longest-serving members of the Oregon Legislature, who indeed did great things while he was here, and he doesn't want to quit, so he's back to add to his illustrious reputation.
Mr. Chairman, I'm back on a pro bono basis also.
Okay, good.
Boy, you served on a pro bono basis.
So, Bill,
well, that's true.
So, Bill, you want to go ahead and introduce yourself, and we will move ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I'm frankly very delighted to be here because it's kind of early in the session, and I'm kind of feeling my way around. I haven't been around here for almost 8 years now, and other than say hello once or twice during the session, I'm delighted to see my senator here. Cruz is been a great proponent over in the House on health care, and I asked him if he could work it out on under Senate regs. If we get a bill here, if he could put his name on it, it'd make me feel good. Anyway, let me say I'm Bill Markham from now in Roseburg. I used to live in Riddle, and I was in the legislature for many, many, many years. And how I became interested in this issue as a volunteer for health care providers, let me say that 1991 session, I believe, 15 years ago, whatever. A doctor in Roseburg, a Dr. Moores, came to me. I didn't know him, and introduced himself one day on the street and said, I'm going to retire, but I'd like to keep my hand in the medical business on a part-time basis at schools or clinics or something. But he said, I'll be damned, if you'll pardon my using that word, quoting him, I'll be damned if I'm going to buy liability insurance to work free. What can you do about it, Markham? So I came up here at the next session, whatever, and put a bill together. And the problem with the bill, I took it back and gave it to the doctor, and he thought it was okay. Then I took it over to county commissioners, because the bill says, and it's in the code now, that whoever volunteers must work under the auspices of the county medical officer. So then I knew, well, I got to go over and show this to the county court, the county commissioners, and they looked at it and called their insurance agent and said, we're not interested. It's going to raise our rates. That, in effect, killed the bill statewide, because nobody, to my knowledge, ever used it. About a year ago, I was in Tacoma visiting one of my sons. Front page of the Tacoma News Tribune, their big paper, was this picture, and it caught my attention. It shows a retired doctor bringing in a patient at one of these low-income or no-income clinics that he volunteers for 3 or 4 days or 3 or 4 nights a month. And it has quite an article on how they do it in Washington. And that caught my attention, and I remembered my fiasco of 15 years earlier, and I got interested when I read the article. And up there, without going into a lot of detail, the state ponies up money, pays the liability insurance on these people who are willing to volunteer. Well, that kind of gives you the background on this thing, and I'll kind of run through this quickly if I may. Then I got to reading the Roseburg articles and the Oregonian articles on health care, because this has spiked my interest, and I knew that 160,000 more or less people have been dumped off the medical, the Kitzhoffer's plan, if you will, because of lack of money. And Cedric Hayden, a former legislator now lobbying for the dentist, tells me yesterday that the governor's budget includes dropping 120,000 people off the dental bill project, whatever you want to call it. So there are a lot of people are getting hurt out there, and they don't have money to take care of themselves. There's a rising number of uninsured citizens. Rising use of the hospital emergency department for primary care has become a real burden on the hospitals, and I can quote you only on the Mercy Hospital in Roseburg, because I don't really know the statewide statistics, but the Mercy emergency ward people back in, I mean, the clinic, the emergency ward had 22,000 people stop in about 3 years ago. Today it's up around 50,000, so it's more than doubled. The cost of the hospital down there is, 2 years ago, fiscal was $9 million. Last year they wrote off $18 million in Roseburg. So there's a lot of reasons why I'm trying to do this, and one of them is to get a lot of those people not going to the emergency ward, going to some of these low-income clinics. And the whole catch to it is figure out a way where they'll want to work and not be burdened by liability insurance. My policy objection, I've got this written out, encourage retired or other health care providers to work on a volunteer basis in community clinics that serve the low-income, uninsured, without the fear of medical liability. And what we're talking about, and I think the third page of that handout shows there's really 19 different forms of health care under the Oregon Code, and each one has its own practice law. So this would cover all of those, and it runs from a medical doctor, if you will, down to an audiologist and pharmacist and you name it, nurse practitioner, the whole bit. And as I understand it, from the state of Washington, there are a lot of them out there that want to work. Now, I'm going to digress, if I may, Mr. Chairman. I overlooked the fact that in Washington, their plan got started in 1992. With just $30,000 seed money or something like that. A year ago, the legislature, because the governor liked the program, ponied up $300,000, as this article says, and now they have about 100 people under the program doing this freebie work around the state, and there's about 27 clinics around the state of Washington, including three in Clark County, one in Chehalis, and one in Olympia. I don't know them all. And I've not visited one. I wished I had of. But the need is there, and I guess these retired people are willing to go if they feel they got some protection. Secondly, here I want to make sure the public and the not-for-profit clinics can utilize this important tool of healthcare talent on a volunteer basis without the fear of medical liability. I want to maximize the availability of primary care, physical, dental, and mental health. And I, like I say, there's a whole list of 19 of them that would be covered. I want to, and the catch, if we can do something in this area, is to how to get out and inform these retiring people that we know are out there and want to do this pro bono work, that it's available and they will have protection. That's going to be the key. Well, as I understand it, just shooting from the hip, there's about 40 lobbyists in this building off and on that represent so many kinds of medicine I can't even imagine, because it's a new field to me. I've never had an interest in it. Well, I've got an interest now, and through those, and as Barney can point out, the OMA and the Nurses Association, there's 25 of those. They'll all put out this publicity if we can get it out that they can now, if they want to, work pro bono. And finally, I'm really testifying on Senate Bill 443, and I'm grateful for the support of Senator Westland and Senator Bates in sponsoring the bill. And I also have a bill in the House side that my House member sponsored, Morgan. I'm told by my two volunteer health policy advisors that... How are you, Senator? I thought his name was Bruce Bishop when I first looked over there.
Yeah.
And anyway, I've got Barney Spade helping me, thank the Lord. And before they take over all this, let me thank the committee for listening to me.
Down to here.
Are there any questions you can ask me? I'll probably refer them, but I'll be more
Do you know who's sitting next to you right over there? Do you know who's sitting there?
Really quick one on you.
Hi, Doc. How are you?
Most of them can't tell us apart anyway, you know.
I wasn't going to say that.
Okay. Questions for Mr. Marco?
Well, not a question. Thank you, Bill. Bill and I had talked about this over the interim also, and I appreciate the work that's been done on this. And I guess what I would like to hear from this panel, the next one is direct their conversation to the amendment, not to the bill. So we're talking about what we want the finished product to be. So
I think I know what you're aimed at, Mr. Senator Cruz, and let me say the Washington plan requires the state to pony up money to pay the liability insurance company. The way we've got this programmed under the amendment, we ignore that side of it and we simply build that wall. If you got volunteers that work within their scope of practice, can do it.
And Mr. Chair, I love the concept. I think this is great public policy, and I'd like to hear from the sponsors.
Okay, so thanks, Bill. We appreciate your being here. Who wants to go first? Ben, Senator West. Senator West.
Senator Ben Westland, Senate District 27. I think all three former state representatives sitting at the witness stand here are in complete accord that this is not only with the bill as written, but the end product is, Senator Cruz. We can do this without any state dollars. There's no fiscal. And the important part of this is not only, as we all want to do, getting primary and preventative medical care to some of our indigent population. The genesis of this bill, the true germ of genius in it, is that it helps motivate the communities and allows them to come up with their own solutions to their own medical needs that they have identified. And they are providers, in this case physicians or pharmacists, in the community that are willing to give of their time to create social safety net programs for their own communities. This is indeed a community-created solution. But these individuals, in order to be able to do this, need the liability protection that this bill would afford. I can't think of perhaps a more important thing than what we could do this session. I really want to thank Representative Markin for bringing this forward and being such a passionate advocate.
I don't see any attorneys in the audience, so I think we're okay.
We would hope that's not against. For the record, I'm State Senator Arnie Bates here, and I want to talk to you about this bill just for a moment, if I could. You know, it's a little embarrassing to me that Representative Markin had to bring this to my attention, because it's an obvious thing we should be doing, and it's a good thing we should be doing. I want to put a couple things on the record, though, that might help out other people who have talked to me about this bill and concerned about it. Clearly, what the bill does with the amendment is it holds harmless the physician or provider, and holds harmless the clinic that allows that individual to work at, harmless for the work done just by that individual, not by anyone who's on staff and is working to make a living there. And we've made that thing pretty clear. There's a couple other pieces, though, you might get questioned on. I want to make this clear also. The bill also speaks to educating retired physician health care providers. We're not interested here in educating any health care providers. We assume that has occurred already. We want to make sure they work within the scope of their practice. And the Board of Medical Examiners and others are going to be concerned that they have some responsibility here. I think the responsibility we'd like to have them take on is, one, a lot of these providers are coming in from out of state and retiring in our area. I've been contacted by multiple physicians from California who were primary caregivers in their community, moved to Southern Oregon to retire and would like to keep on working a day or 2 weeks on a volunteer basis, and they were blocked both by the difficulty of being sued and the difficulty of going ahead and getting their license renewed or taken care of in Oregon. And that would be a responsibility that would go back to the licensing boards, no question about it. The other piece of it is, I don't want the licensing boards to think that we expect them to go out and send a letter to every physician, nurse, practitioner, nurse, PA, or anything else in the state telling them about this program. Simply putting a paragraph in their annual newsletters or monthly newsletters would be more than adequate. It wouldn't cost them anything. So I don't even think we're putting a financial burden on any of these boards. Their job would be to license within the scope of practice, and through their normal channels of communication, let people know this is available. They need not go out and spend a lot of money on this. I want that in the record so they won't have any opposition to this. Okay?
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Bates. You know, that's one way of getting the word out. The other way is just in the community, and I think that's probably going to be the most effective way, is because you're going to know who retired docs in your community, and community leaders will know, and so that's the way that I think most of these people will get engaged in this is through word of mouth at local level. So.
Yep. Thank you.
Yes, Senator Myers. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really feel that we need to take advantage of our retired health care providers. I'm going to play a little devil's advocate here, though, and I need some responses. I have worked in a free clinic, not in the state of Oregon, but in the state of Virginia for several years. And the free clinics do tend to be the people that we saw were sicker. People in poverty tend to avoid coming into the health care situation until they're really sick. And I am concerned about those situations in which something would be overlooked, whether it's a tumor or a treatment done that it should have been something else. So how would, if that type of case or situation occurred, a good attorney would probably still be able to help this client. So can you give a patient? So could you tell me how in those cases in which maybe there was really improper or not improper, but just an event that was just overlooked, that didn't get adequate treatment, and so they were taken to court. I want to know how this bill protects that retired physician when he obviously didn't. When you're in free clinics, you don't necessarily have the best equipment. You don't have X-rays. You don't have lots of different things that you would have maybe in a regular physician's office. And improper treatment could happen. They could be going to the free clinic for several months, et cetera, and then all of a sudden they end up in the hospital because there really was something wrong internally that should have been diagnosed far sooner. I just want to know how the doctor will be protected.
Now, before you answer that, you might include the clinic itself protected as well as the doctor.
Senator Morissette, Mr. Chair, and Senator Hans Anderson, it is my understanding, and I would have to get LCEC to be absolutely certain of this, that this actually falls under the Good Samaritan Act, and that there is immunity there for the physician working on these conditions if this bill is passed, and that immunity, because of this bill, would extend also to the clinic that hired that person. I think the other question you may be asking me is, what happens to the patient under those conditions? What recourse that patient have? My answer to that is twofold. One, that that negligence can occur in any setting in healthcare. Frankly, I think in this kind of a setting, it's probably less likely to. And the reason I say that is because, generally speaking, when you're doing pro bono work or work of this nature, you have a tendency to take care of what is obvious needs to be taken care of, and to use a really strong medical term, punt the rest of it as quickly as you can if you have any kind of consideration that more technology is needed, more imaging is needed, or something of that nature. These people, when you're working in these conditions, are the very neediest. You are sometimes the only person, because I've done this, by the way, you're the only person they're going to have a chance to see. And what the net result usually is you find things that would never have been found otherwise, because those people get no health care until it's too late. And you pick up things much earlier, and are much more beneficial to the patient. You also have a tendency, as I said, to quickly move any patient you have concerns about, because of your limitations in those settings, onto an emergency room to get them care. So I can't give an ample answer that every single time there'll never be a problem, because there ultimately will be a problem. Let's not kid ourselves. There's no way it can't be a problem. But I would say that in this setting, it's probably less of a problem than the setting of a doctor's office where you're doing primary care on a fee basis. I hope it's an adequate answer.
May I? Yes.
If I may, Senator, the clinics in Washington, it's non-invasive work they do. They sew people up. They got cuts. They take care of boils. This is in their statute, pardon the expression. So they refer people if they got problems, real problems. And if I may, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to read this two paragraphs, if I may, along this line. Uninsured people, on the average, get medical care late in the course of illness or die sooner than insured people, said Dr. Bruce Goldberg, who I'm sure you people know, head of the office here. People who are uninsured are nearly three times as likely as the insured to be hospitalized for diabetics, more than twice as likely to be hospitalized for high blood pressure, and nearly twice as likely to be hospitalized for pneumonia or ulcers, according to Goldberg. So the need of those clinics, I'm trying to point out, is there. Because when they end up in the emergency ward, if they had gotten to one of these clinics, they wouldn't have to go there, and that's one of the points that I didn't make, that I'm trying to reduce the number of people who have to go to the emergency ward because it's overrunning the hospitals in cost. So I'm kind of run out of stuff here to say, so thank you.
Okay, in this, I don't know if you have the... you want to comment on that?
Yes, Chair. I do have in front of you, connect your staff mission summary, a copy of the ORS's, and 30.782 does say that the immunity applies, shall not apply to instances of gross negligence. So they're immune from, under the Good Samaritan exceptions, there's gross negligence involved. So there is that protection built into the current statute.
And I think that...
If you want to identify yourself again.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westlingen. Senator Moniz-Anderson, I appreciate your question, and I appreciate the fact that there still remains protections and recourse for those people that have been egregiously, and that might be the wrong specific thing, egregiously injured through oversight or lack of care. But by far and away, the far more serious conditions will be found, identified, and referred to appropriate care than would be overlooked in this bill. I would not lose the plausible in pursuit of the perfect care.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Vancouver, Washington has a wonderful free clinic. In fact, there's waiting lists almost for at least the nursing friends of mine that live in Vancouver, Washington. And I would love to see clinics like that, occurring throughout the state of Oregon. But I still have a concern, and I would love to get more information from, say, that one clinic in Vancouver, Washington, on the types of procedures that they do and the limitations that they put on their health care providers. And they may. I don't know.
Senator Starr, and then
I want to commend you. This is one step in the direction of what I have been trying to preach for several years, and that is that in order to meet the needs of our citizens, we have to have more volunteerism. We need to utilize those folks who have retired in good health and would benefit from the opportunity to volunteer in the community to provide services. I can't help but think about the free clinic in the village of Lalaway in northern Cameroon, where my son, who has no medical training but has been raised up on the farm, provides treatment and sanitation for native villagers there, and frequently, as he did today, hauls them into the hospital when they have needs. HIV patient, he transported to the hospital this morning. And It's wonderful if we can get more of our citizens involved in delivering service, not just medical service, but just general care. We will be able to reach much more of the needs of our citizens than we'll ever be able to finance out of the general fund. So I thank you for this effort, and I'm surely in support of this issue.
Thank you. Yeah, Senator, just kind of an end, and I think Barney can probably speak to this also, but to Senator Mona Sanderson's concern, you know, the clinics already exist. This doesn't expand their scope of practice. This just gives them more practitioners to offer services. Maybe we get some more clinics in the long run, but this is just, you know, clinics are overrun with, they got more people than they have people that can see them. This just gives us more people, more practitioners in the setting, but it's not like suddenly we're creating a new model of healthcare delivery. It's the same one. It's just putting more people on the ground. So,
Mr. Chair, if I could, I think this is something where you have to kind of be.
We don't have voice recognition in this building. I'm sorry,
Mr. Chair. This is Senator Bates again.
Great, thank you.
I think this is an issue you have to be sort of pragmatic on, you know, looking at the overall good against any possible negative effect. The physicians, nurse practitioners, and the people coming into this program will be working inside a clinic where they'll be seen by other people, other practitioners. I'm sure they'll be very quick to say if someone's outside their scope of practice or obviously not functioning the level they should because of age or the problem, that's going to be stopped. I just don't see that as a significant problem. Can something be missed that should have been picked up? Possibly, but I think it's doubtful. I think it's much more likely, and in the vast majority of cases, things will be found that wouldn't have been found otherwise. Patient will come in with a cut finger, and as they talk to the physician or the nurse practitioner, they'll find things out. My experience in working with the migrant clinic that we used to have, it was a freestanding clinic, was that is exactly what happened. And as a result, people were taken care of and treated and referred to a subspecial care when it was necessary, and it was absolutely life-saving, and those people would not have been found that early in their disease, would have either died or had a situation occur where they had been maimed for the rest of their lives. And I could give you case after case after case where that happened. So I'm imploring you to don't throw out the good for the perfect. This is something I think will work and will be helpful, and we should move it forward. Thank you.
I think we're at the top of our game right now, and anything else that's said is going to be on the downhill slope.
We do need
an amendment for this bill, which we will get, and then we'll come back and we will have a public hearing and we'll have the work session, and we will pass this out and put wings on it. It'll fly where it's needed. So thank you very much. I appreciate
thank you.
It.
Thank you.
Now, if you guys want to put frosting on the cake, you can do that, but
we'll leave it alone.
Okay.
Good.
Thank you.
Can I bring my right and left hand man?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Be sure you know which ones are sitting next to you, though.
You're done.
Okay, seriously, Scott, Barney, Bruce, Ed, do you guys want to...
I just want to work with committee staff and ask to get an amendment as it's been discussed today.
Scott, are you okay? Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, yes. Committee members, and rest assured I'll work with
now,
whatever.
Tell us where you're going from here again. Where are you
going? I'm going to Washington. I miss my lady friend's Valentine's Day.
Okay.
So
Washington State or B.C.?
Up in Olympia, sir.
Oh, Olympia. Oh, okay. I thought you were having dinner in the White House today.
Not this week.
Good. Okay, we close the public hearing on Senate Bill 98. We will open the public hearing. Oh, I'm sorry. We will close public hearing on Senate Bill 443 and open the public hearing on Senate Bill 98. Senate Bill 98. Yeah, explain Senate Bill 98.
Thank you, Senator. This is the bill that the committee heard in Newport at its hearing on the 4th. Basically, what this bill does is it allows the Department of Human Services to delegate licensing functions of adult foster homes for elderly and disabled persons to Type B Area Agency on Aging, and it also exempts foster homes in counties that have been granted exemption, and then defines adult foster homes. At the Newport hearing, it was pointed out that the contracts for these Type B agencies will be coming up rather quickly, and so the bill needed an amendment, an emergency clause effective upon passage, which is attached to the bill, the dash ones. That's what I have, Senator. Thank you.
Okay. Do we have anyone to testify on that?
No.
Anyone? Did anyone sign up to testify? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I'd be interested in moving the bill.
Okay, we are going to. Okay, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 98, and we will open a work session on Senate Bill 98.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Cruz.
I move the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 98.
Senator Cruz moves the dash one amendment to Senate Bill 98. Discussion? Again, hearing no discussion and no disagreements. We're okay? Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move Senate Bill 98 as amended to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Senate Bill 98 has been moved by Senator Cruz to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Seeing no discussion. Any disagreement? Seeing no disagreement, we will move Senate Bill 98 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. And Rick? I'm sorry, Senator Mitchell. Would you like to carry this down?
We're happy to, sir.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we are now on. Close the work session on Senate Bill 98. Open the public hearing on Senate Bill 430.
Senate Bill 430 clarifies that a provider, resident manager, or substitute caregiver, an adult foster home prior to providing care to clients is required to have education and training on client health, safety, and welfare. Requires adult foster home providers fulfill continuing education requirements. Requires the Department of Human Services to require that foster homes complete 14 hours of continuing education annually in care of elderly and persons with disabilities and business operations of the home. Prohibits the home from fulfilling the minimum 14-hour continuing education requirements with more than 7 hours of business training. There are attached to your staff measure summary the dash one amendments. Basically, what this does on the very last page of the amendment, page 3, line 24, it changes the overall number of continuing education that homes require from 14 to 12, and then changes the number that homes can use for business operation training from 7 to 4.
Okay, Grover, would you, and Meredith, would you please come up, please, both of you? Grover. Mr. Simmons.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons. I represent the Independent Adult Foster Home Association. Thank you very much for agreeing to hear Senate Bill 430. 4 years ago, the federal government undertook massive auditing of adult foster homes in the state of Washington. And the upshot of that extensive auditing was the closure of many, many homes. Heavy fines were imposed on foster homes, and there were lots of homes in violation of wage and hour laws. So the expectation 4 years ago was that whenever the federal government finishes in Washington, they will be coming to Oregon to audit our industry for foster homes. And so in the 2001 session, we introduced a bill with respect to continuing education credits to allow some training for business education. The law required 10 credits, continuing education credits, be accomplished annually for providers and resident managers. The bill in 2001 said that up to 5 of those 10 units could be used for business training. The bill failed, and I have a parenthesis, big time, because there was a room full of advocates who opposed the bill. They almost lined up to testify against it. It did pass the Senate. Senator Starr was a principal sponsor of that bill in 2001, and it passed the Senate. It got over to the House, and it died in committee at the end of the session. So here we are, 4 years later, with another bill, because adult foster home providers and resident managers still need business training. This new version, however, is a little bit different. I conceded that we couldn't hold the line at 10, so I agreed to go to 14, well, not agreed, I proposed that we go to 14 units, and up to 7 could be used for business training. Well, Cindy Hannum called me over to her office one afternoon, not very long ago, and I was pleased to go. We met, and she said, well, we want to give you a bill, but some of the advocates are opposed to the bill. How about 8 units for hands-on and 4 units for business training, for a total of 12 instead of 14? And I said, you have a deal. So the department and the industry is in agreement now on a new set of numbers, which frankly is better for the industry, because to require 14 units of continuing education credit is truly a burden on the industry, and the people in the rural districts tell me they have a very difficult time getting even 10 units per year accomplished. So to add 4 units, it would be quite a struggle for them. However, we need business training so desperately that originally I was proposing 14, but I feel much better at 12, and Mrs. Hannum feels better at 12, and up to 4 units could be used for business, and we are happy about that and satisfied with those numbers. So I said, you have a deal. Now, when the bill went to, the original bill went to legislative council for drafting, they did a little creative writing, which I didn't request and the department did not request. And there's one sentence that Cindy would like to call your attention to. Actually, she wants to go back, and we concur, go back to the original existing law, except put those two new numbers in there. That's all. 12 and up to 4 for business. 12, 8, and 4. 3 new numbers.
Not sure what you're saying. Are you saying that there needs to be an amendment to this bill?
Yes, sir.
Where? Exactly. What line are you talking about?
That would be on, and I gave Rick a copy of the amendment on Friday, so it would be, line 10, Mr. Chairman, on the original bill.
Oh. Okay,
That's not the amendment.
That's not the amendment.
Thank you. Line 10 on the original bill. The current law says the rules shall require that no person may provide care to any resident prior to acquiring education and so forth. The language that the legislative drafters put in said, the rule shall require that a provider, resident manager, or substitute caregiver may not provide care. So it's a more limited bill than what we were proposing and what Cindy wants to go back to. So we're in complete agreement with going back to the current law and change numbers only.
Okay. We'll get to that in a minute.
Okay. Thank you. I apologize for not having a -2 amendment.
There's some disagreement, I guess, of whether or not we need to go back, but we'll talk about that in
okay.
a minute.
Meredith. In any event, that concludes my testimony, and it's nice to be in concurrence with the department for a change of life.
It's about time.
Thank you. 21 years.
No, I just want to say, Grover, I've worked with you for the last three, four sessions, and you've worked very, very, very hard on behalf of your clients. And
thank
I
you, sir.
Congratulate you on your hard work.
I thank you so very much.
Thanks. Meredith.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Meredith Cote, and I'm the state long-term care ombudsman and direct the office of the long-term care ombudsman. I'm here today not because I oppose the bill per se, although I do believe that the objectives here could be accomplished by rule, but I did want to point out to the committee a couple of things that the bill may not have addressed as it's written and that I would appreciate that the committee consider. One of those things is that, well, first of all, the continuing education requirement for foster care providers, as for every other kind of provider, is an administrative rule. And in my testimony, I've outlined that basically the provision says that it should be 10 hours, and it talks about that it should be care-related. And this bill changes things in a couple of ways, and I'm not opposed to the agreement reached by the department and Mr. Simmons about whether we should have 8 or 10 hours of continuing education related to care. I'm willing to concede that probably there's not a material difference there, but I am concerned because what SB 430 is silent on is that in the rule it specifically says, as it does for all providers, that the continuing education should be division approved, and the bill is silent on that point. Second, the rule also includes shift caregivers for those foster care homes that may not have a resident manager. And so the bill is also silent on the continuing education of shift caregivers. And I'm concerned that because it's silent, it addresses resident managers and providers and not caregivers, that the assumption would then be, as one interprets the law, that shift caregivers don't have an obligation to have continuing ed any longer. So those are the two issues that we're concerned about, and we think that they could be easily remedied if the committee decides that it would rather go and have a bill rather than dealing with this through rule. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I guess I've always felt that many things can be done by administrative rule and should be, if possible. I've always been concerned that administrative rules can be moved either way, and if you really want to make sure something is done, you do it in statute. However, sometimes administrative rule is more appropriate. I'm not making a judgment on this right now. You've made note of the concerns that...
And Mr. Chair, if I might add, I agree with you 100% on that. And the only thing that I have seen over time, as I've seen as the long-term care environment has changed, yeah, and provider needs and resident needs have changed, that there has been, you know, in rule, a reexamination of continuing ed and what should be encompassed, yeah, in that and how many hours. And this would not allow that flexibility.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Cindy, did you have something to add to that?
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Hannum, and I am over the Office of Licensing and Quality of Care for DHS. Mr. Simmons is right. We did have that conversation, and I would like him to have a bill. That is true. I also think that Meredith has actually made some very good points. I think we can compromise on this and meet exactly the objectives Grover would like. I'm not sure how you would like us to proceed.
Go forth and do good and come back.
Come back and we'll hold hands and have an amendment for you?
You can all three of you can sit there.
We shall do that. Okay. We shall do that. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Cindy. Others wishing to testify? I'm sorry, any comments?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we haven't had any caregivers testify, and caregivers that maybe could be represented, having had a mother live in a foster care home and knowing what it's like to care for someone in their home and to then get time off, and maybe they'll get paid by the manager, maybe they won't. I mean, there's all these questions that I have regarding these people who need to go out and pay a fee, and who's going to pay that fee, and who's going to manage to make sure every caregiver has the continuing education. It would be nice to know how this would impact certain foster care homes, and there's no providers here.
Okay. Good point. I guess I'll just say that I think the foster care homes are the single most effective care given to seniors, because it is a very personal care in a home, and people who do it because they want to do it. But the cost of continuing education, I think, is something that might be a problem. I don't know. We don't have anybody here to testify. But I would, again, ask that you get together and come back to us with an amendment, and we will have another hearing, and maybe there will be people showing up. But okay. Any other comments?
I have one.
Yes.
Well, that's good. Yeah, and I think, and I appreciate what Senator Montes Anderson had to say, and when you do come back, maybe if it is possible to have some providers or others to talk about issues, because also having a family member right up the street from Senator Montes Anderson, who's an adult foster care home, and had a concern too about the well-being of the caregivers in these homes, and because they do work hard, and part of continuing education in terms of caring for a resident, means how to do things properly so you don't hurt themselves, and it's where I learned that there was an exemption from workers' comp for adult foster homes, which we're hoping to solve. I have a bill to require that they carry workers' comp. Because all of a sudden you have a person who is employed in an adult foster care home, and they don't have the right training, and they injure themselves, and then they end up in the emergency room because they're not covered. So I think, and this education is part of, how do you treat, how do you care for people and do it properly so you don't hurt yourself also. I mean, it's part of the reason I think we have training. And so I just like to, like Senator Montes Anderson said, just, get a real feel for, what we're giving up and what we're gaining. Certainly the business part is important too, but I would be interested to hear some caregivers on that.
Okay. Good. Other comments? Okay. You were out of the room, so you wouldn't know what to comment on.
So we're done. Now that you're back, we're done.
I know the bill I was talking about some
before the gavel's off, we'd like to say. We'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 443 and urge that you come back. What? 430. Okay, we did 430. And we'll adjourn. Thank you very much.